These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by the Teaching Company. These lectures are titled A Brief History of the World, Part 3. Lecture 25, Abolition of Slavery and Serfdom.
One of the big changes in world history during the long 19th century, actually starting in the late 18th and extending to 1914 and even beyond, was a process through which formal slavery was abolished throughout really the entire world, and attacks were also made on the harshest forms of serfdom, though there were more survivals here. This change deserves attention for several reasons. In the first place, big picture, slavery, as has been obvious from our discussions, was one of the oldest institutions in human society. Because of capture in war, because of inherited status, because of greedy seizure of other people, even in one's own society, the patterns varied, but the impulse to try to gain ownership over other people and their labor obviously goes deep in the human experience. The century that brought this institution to a close deserves significant attention in this longer perspective. The development in the 19th century also demands attention. In some ways, the abolition of slavery in the 19th century, although of course we know it happened, might seem counterintuitive. After all, in many ways, this was a century in which exploitative economic practices increased, the world economy extended, and with it, efforts to get peripheral societies to produce cheap goods with cheap labor. Obviously, we now have to note that even though the concept of peripheral economies remains valid, as we discussed previously, we now have increasingly to detach it from literally coercive labor, which was one of the definitional characteristics in the early modern period. So what we need to do in charting this really significant change is talk about the issue of causation, particularly given the fact that once we understand slavery's deep roots and understand the exploitative economic relationships that dominate many other aspects of world history in the long 19th century, causation doesn't spring to mind immediately, and almost inevitably it has been much debated. And then after dealing with causation, talk a little bit about the process, because although changes began early, the British, for example, worked to abolish Atlantic slave trade after 1808, although changes began early, the process really stretched through the whole period and, as I've already indicated, slopped over slightly into the 20th century as well. And then we need to talk about consequences, because here too, predictably, although slavery really was abolished and that really is an historical change, the actual consequences were messy, diverse, globally involved, and equally inevitably, the results were perhaps not quite as benign as some of the proponents of abolition might have hoped. The beginnings of arguments against slavery, they weren't brand new in the long 19th century, but the beginnings of arguments against slavery began to take shape particularly coherently in the final decades of the 18th century. Two sources predominated in places like England, the Netherlands, France, Scandinavia, and increasingly some sectors of opinion in British North America. Two sources predominated. First were maverick or new Protestant religious groups, Methodists, for example, and Quakers, particular among them, who used Christianity, as it had not been used in the early modern period, to argue that the enslavement of other people was immoral, improper, and must be ended. Combining with this, sometimes in the same individuals, sometimes in separate groups, was the force of Enlightenment thinking, the kind of thinking that went into the revolutionary wave of the late 18th, early 19th centuries as well. Enlightenment arguments could certainly be used against slavery. Enlightenment thinkers tended to stress the fundamental equality of all human beings. They tended to target exploitation, of which slavery was the worst example. They sometimes could add also utilitarian arguments, that slavery was not only wrong, but inefficient in a society that ought to be bent on more effective motivations for labor and productivity. Agitation in anti-slavery groups took a number of forms. It wasn't a constant force from the late 18th to the early 19th century, but periodically waves of outrage would develop. Huge petitions were signed in England and other places against slavery practices, pressing the British government to act against slavery internationally, and particularly, of course, to act against slavery in the British colonies. These petitions, on occasion, could command an amazing percentage of urban populations, for example, in some of the new factory centers in Great Britain. Along with petitions came efforts to educate larger numbers of people in the evils of slavery. Plays, pamphlets, ultimately, for example, materials, literary materials like Uncle Tom's Cabin, which was widely popularized not only in the United States but also Western Europe. These materials were used to help bring additional people into the anti-slavery crusade. Boycotts were even sketched, although they probably weren't terribly effective, but an interesting tactic in which people were urged to identify goods like sugar that were slave-produced and try to find alternatives. This was a major campaign, and it obviously gradually had effects. The French Revolution added fuel to the fire. French revolutionary principles, obviously building from the Enlightenment, also argued against slavery, and during the radical phase of the Revolution, legislation was introduced to abolish slavery in the French colonies. During the 1790s also, the Great Haitian Revolution, which was a revolution both against French colonial control and against slavery, added force to the anti-slavery arguments, obviously illustrating the capacity of former slaves to rise against the institution and build a new society, also possibly increasing fears in slave-owning sectors that protest might attack the institution directly as well if something new was not undertaken. The key innovation in all this, and this is certainly one cause of this huge historical change, the key innovation in all this was what several historians have identified as a new kind of humanitarian thinking, again, could derive from maverick strands of Christianity or the Enlightenment or both. And the key principle here was that moral concern could and should now extend to situations that were distant from one's own, that involved people that were different from oneself, that involved people who might not even share one's own religion. The great world religions had obviously already permitted concern about distant others if they were in your religion, concern about Christians in the Holy Land, concern about conditions among Muslims as other Muslims learned about them on the great pilgrimage to Mecca. But this new humanitarian thinking went even beyond this to suggest a moral responsibility for unjust conditions virtually anywhere in the world, of which slavery now seemed to be the most obvious and the most objectionable. This was an important force, and it had ready audience. The concern about morality also spread to other areas. For example, at the end of the 18th century, some Russian nobles, like a man named Radishev, who had traveled in the West and who knew Enlightenment thinking and sometimes had some familiarity with the French Revolution as well. Thinkers like Radishev wrote convincingly against Russian serfdom on two grounds. First, it was inefficient. Radishev toured the Russian countryside and argued that serfs simply did not work very hard for their masters, but when they were allowed to work on their own plots of land, on Sundays, for example, they worked extremely productively. Russian economy would be better off, so this argument went, if serfdom were abolished. But, again, the moral component was here as well. Regardless of economic efficiency, Radishev argued, Russian serfdom was evil and should be dropped. Radishev's writings were not published. Catherine the Great prevented this. They were indeed published only after the 20th century communist revolution. But the attack was revealing. It showed the potential for certain kinds of thinking that initially developed in the West to spread more broadly. The actual pattern of emancipation and abolition was gradual and varied. The French Revolution, for France itself and for surrounding territories, abolished serfdom permanently in much of Western Europe. The abolition of serfdom would extend into central Germany and Austria through the revolutions of 1848. The institution seemed to be incompatible with modern Enlightenment-style political principles. As noted, Britain sponsored an abolition of the Atlantic slave trade in 1808. Some trade still got through British blockades, but effectively, the big days of the slave trade were over. Britain abolished slavery in the colonies, in colonies like Jamaica, in 1833. The French Revolution of 1848 extended the attack on slavery in the French colonies. Slavery was clearly on the ropes. In some of the Latin American independence wars in the early 19th century, for example, in Mexico, the abolition of slavery was part of this process of revolt, although in the bigger slaveholding societies in Latin America, emancipation occurred noticeably later. Russia moved against serfdom in 1861, and a major emancipation there deserves comparison with abolition movements in other societies. The argument, obviously, was humanitarian in part based on a sense that Russian social conditions were lagging behind the standards of the civilized world, i.e. the West, and the embarrassment factor, once again, Russia needed to improve its standing by ridding itself of this awful institution. But a more pragmatic motive was clearly involved as well. The defeat of Russia in the Crimean War convinced many Russian leaders that the institution of serfdom was a drawback to Russian economic and military performance. Russia needed a more flexible labor supply, one that could move around at greater need as economic resources and demands required. The question of why this occurred has obviously bedeviled historians, and it is not easy to resolve it. We know one component. There is simply no doubt that the points already made, the emergence of new kinds of humanitarian arguments and effective political campaigns based on these arguments, involving the mobilization of public opinion, the use of petitions, educational campaigns, etc. We know that this was a factor. But, not surprisingly, many types of historians have been concerned that too much emphasis on humanitarianism might be oversimple, might lead to a conclusion that somehow the West had found a conscience in a period when, in other respects, the West was hardly pure as the driven snow. So other options have been sought, and they need to be explored as well. Additional argument number one. Slavery and harsh serfdom were uneconomical. On the whole, historians who have analyzed this argument, and it's a powerful argument, have concluded that it's probably incorrect, that this was not a major motive for abolition. Slavery was still very economically effective in producing sugar. This was the height of the use of slavery for cotton production. The crassest economic reasons for ending slavery probably don't apply, although larger considerations, like those, for example, in post-Crimean Russia, larger considerations about the need for greater labor mobility may still have operated, whether they were correct or not. Some historians have even demonstrated, looking at the American South, that you could even have applied slavery to the creation of factory industry, although this was not widely done. The notion that slavery died because it was economically ineffective is probably overall a non-starter, but it has been asserted. A more circuitous self-interest argument does also merit consideration. Some people have argued that some of the moral fervor devoted to attacks on slavery were designed to distract industrial workers in centers like Northern England from their own plight, get them excited about the conditions of distant peoples, get them outraged against distant planters, and maybe they'll forget about the fact that their own conditions were really pretty vile. Whether this was deliberately understood or not can be debated, but I suspect that one has to grant there was an element here in which people were directing morality against distant evils as a convenient means of ignoring evils under their own noses. The evils may have been greater. It is also important to note that the Atlantic system, the American system of slavery, was a particularly harsh and degrading form of slavery compared to slave situations earlier in world history, in the classical world or the Islamic Middle East, for example. So we don't want to forget that this was a real set of atrocities that were being addressed, that some of the propaganda about abuse of slaves was based on grim reality. But we don't have to rely on humanitarian sentiment alone. There may have been other factors. Another factor that must be considered is the concern about slave revolts or individual acts of defiance by individual slaves. The abolition of slavery, except in a few important single instances like Haiti, the abolition of slavery did not directly result solely from slave protest. But we want to remember that slaves were active in their own behalf, that former slaves like Frederick Douglass in the American North were eloquent in their attacks on this institution, and their voices and their protest or potential protest needed to be added to the mix as well. Finally, and actually I think this has been underdeveloped in the larger exploration of causes of the demise of slavery, we also must keep in mind the larger global demographic context. In the 19th century, population rates were increasing, although at different speeds, in most parts of the world. And this meant, and we'll see the application of this more fully in a moment, this meant that there were now alternatives to slavery in terms of sources of relatively available and, frankly, fairly cheap labor. You could call on the growing numbers of people who were crowding the countryside in Southern Europe, in Asia, elsewhere. You could call on these people to replace slave labor without necessarily losing much of a step in terms of economic profitability. Slavery, of course, did not die a painless death. Slave owners, in many cases, argued fervently for the importance of retaining the institution. They might appeal to property rights, and property rights loomed large in the thinking of political leaders in many places in the 19th century. But they might also, and this was an interesting connection between Southern American planters and Russian landlords, not a deliberate connection, just a coincidence of approach. They might also argue, in addition to property rights, that slavery was an essential institution to provide guidance and motivation to childlike peoples. Russian aristocrats, not the ones influenced by Western thinking, but the ones who were arguing for special Russian needs and conditions. Russian aristocrats might argue that the serfs could be charming people, but they were essentially children. And if they didn't have kindly landlords telling them what to do, organizing things for them, they would simply fall apart. Emancipation, in this sense, would be a disaster not just to Russian society, but to the very people that the reformers wanted to assist. And obviously, American Southerners made much the same case. But the efforts to resist the tide of abolition lost. As noted, slavery and serfdom were abolished in the Western world and in territories under Western control by the middle of the 19th century. Slavery and serfdom were abolished in Russia and the United States in the 1860s. Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation was motivated certainly by some sense of the injustice of slavery, but also with a careful eye cocked to world opinion, Abolishing slavery in the secessionist states was a means of conciliating British and French public opinion, which was otherwise slightly inclined to sympathize with the South against the competitive industrial North. So this factor of opinion as well as morality was beginning to come into clear play. Slavery was attacked by European imperialists as they moved into Africa. Indeed, the argument that imperialism was essential to counter what was in fact a growing use of slavery in the 19th century African economy was one of the big arguments, one of the big humanitarian white man's burden arguments for imperialism. Wasn't the main reason the imperialists went in, but they really did work against slavery once they seized the reins of government in Africa. The abolition of slavery extended to additional parts of Latin America. Later in the 19th century, the abolition of slavery in Brazil in 1882 was a huge move. And again, Brazilian reformers by this point were picking up the twin arguments of humanitarian injustice and the sense that civilized world opinion was now hostile to this institution and hostile to societies that didn't get on the bandwagon appropriately. Slavery was abolished also in the later 19th century in places like Cuba. And now, finally, the anti-slavery forces began to attack the other stronghold of slavery in parts of the Middle East. And efforts to persuade local Middle Eastern rulers to renounce slavery extended from the later 19th into the early 20th century. By, say, 1923, the formal legal institution of slavery was effectively ended. And this, as noted, was a huge historic change. The abolition of serfdom or serf-like conditions was a little less systematic, but here too there were major gains. Serfdom was abolished in other parts of Eastern Europe, for example, in the later 1860s in places like Romania, in the wake of Russian reforms. So this was a huge movement. It derived from complicated causes, but it represents a major change in global conditions in the 19th century, and a major change in one of the staples of world history up to that point. What were the consequences? I think there are four categories here that deserve attention, and I'll start with the most immediate and work to the more general. First, obviously, specific emancipations, although they might derive from similar causes, actually had very different solutions to the problem of what would happen after slavery. When slavery was abolished in Jamaica, for example, in 1833, the abolitionists who had been extremely hostile to slavery turned out not to have paid very much attention to what would happen to the slaves once the institution was ended. Their moral fervor was very clear when it directed against something, more diffuse and ineffective when it came to, well, what's going to come next. Way stations were established that provided a period of years in which Jamaican slaves could still be bound, for example, to apprenticeships. Only gradually did full abolition occur. Russian emancipation in the early 1860s, where serfdom was concerned, was considerably more generous than American abolition. Only in a very few regions were American slaves directly given land after the abolition of slavery, whereas in Russia, a complicated formula was designed to let peasants have the access to most land while still preserving the aristocracy as a class. So peasants got a good bit of the land, although they deeply resented the fact that they didn't get all of it. The landlords kept some, and they viewed this sum as including the more productive. They did get the land, but they were required to pay redemption payments to help provide financial means that would preserve the aristocracy, even in serfdom's absence. And they were tied to their village, at least to some extent, until these redemption payments were satisfied. This was, again, in terms of strict economics, a more generous solution than that adopted in the United States. But because Russian serfs were in the majority, because restrictions seemed particularly annoying precisely because so much had been gained. It was as if half a loaf had been achieved, but the rest of the loaf was still absent. Russian emancipation, ironically, triggered a recurrent series of peasant protests against their remaining obligations, against their landlords, against the redemption system, a series of peasant protests that would continue to crescendo into the 20th century, feeding the Russian Revolution of 1905, and then feeding as well the Great Russian Revolution of 1917. Conditions in the United States, where African American ex-slaves were treated less generously, but were smaller in number, and were subjected to a number of vigorous racist attacks. The aftermath here was different, not necessarily healthier in terms of the society as a whole, but less conducive directly to significant social protest. So, point one, the abolition of slavery and serfdom had varied effects in terms of what happened to the former slaves and serfs, in terms of political consequences, and one has here to go on something of a case-by-case basis. It's also been argued in the case of American slavery that another aftermath of slavery was an increase of racism. Now that people of color could not be subjected to servitude directly in law, many people who had become accustomed to their superiority over people of color now manifested their claims and their uncertainties in increasingly overt racism. This phenomenon was noticeably more marked in the United States than in Latin America. Latin American racism was less virulent. Among other things, Latin Americans differed from citizens of the United States in not necessarily regarding someone who had some colored blood in their background as clearly African. Gradations were smoother. But it has also been noted, although overt racism was and is less of a factor in Latin American society where slavery had previously existed, nevertheless, the people of darkest color tend to be lowest on the economic totem pole. Some degree of prejudice and identification obviously persisted here, too, in the aftermath of slavery. Impact number two. Not surprisingly, although not pleasantly, many societies saw efforts to revive conditions that had some similarity to slavery, even though they weren't quite as bad in terms of strict legal onus. In Brazil, for example, for a while, orphans were deliberately recruited into the labor force without any choice of their own, treated effectively as slaves, at least until they became adult. In the Belgian Congo, under King Leopold, while slavery was abolished, African workers were forced into mine work on pain of physical mutilation, a situation whose differences from slavery, frankly, are too subtle for anyone clearly to discern. Slave-like conditions, or at least conditions that evoke slavery, might also result from harsh sharecropping systems, where people, although legally free, could work the land only if they agreed to heavy taxation in kind as a result of their tenure. And in this system, it often became very difficult to get out from under the burdens to the actual landowners. Or in many factories in Mexico, as well as in the United States, conditions of indebtedness were used effectively to tie workers to their owners. That is, workers had to shop in company stores, they piled up big debts, they were not legally free to leave their employ until these debts were resolved, but wages were too low really to permit this. Even in more recent times, semi-slavery has been produced, for example, in some of the Pacific Islands under United States control, where textile companies recruit labor from Asia, seize the passports of the workers and tell them if they don't work well, they will automatically be shipped home because they have no voice over their own conditions. Again, a familiar enough point. Slavery was gone, but what we could, I think, legitimately regard as semi-slavery cropped up in all sorts of different places. Impact number three, particularly impact of the abolition of slavery in the Americas. With slavery gone, labor needs now had to be satisfied by looking for new streams of immigration. One source in the later 19th century involves Southern and Eastern Europe, where large numbers of people from Spain, Italy, Poland, etc., came to the Americas, came to places like Brazil and Argentina, significantly adding to ethnic diversity, contributing relatively cheap wage labor, at least keeping the price of wages down because of their sheer numbers. Even more interesting, as a response to the abolition of slavery, was the new flood of emigration out of parts of Asia, from the Philippines, from China, from Japan, a bit later from Korea, and also from India. Huge numbers of workers coming to places like the Pacific coast of Latin America, coming to the Caribbean, coming to other parts of Southeast Asia itself, often in conditions of indentured servitude, i.e., contracts would be signed for 5 or 7 years, during which the laborer was obligated to perform his or her tasks. This was not slavery. Some of these people later achieved freedom and could actually make significant economic headway. But a really interesting extension of the abolition of slavery into new worldwide patterns of labor organization and migration streams, a very important development in the later 19th century that would continue, obviously, to resonate in the 20th. Finally, final consequence, the kind of moral outrage, the kind of world opinion that had been mobilized against slavery didn't end with the abolition of slavery itself. In the later 19th century, for example, some of the same kinds of moral outrage, petitions, education campaigns, etc., were directed at new evils, such as the exploitation, the brutal exploitation of workers in the Belgian Congo, a major organization devoted to this cause, or to the phenomenon of white slavery, the notion that large numbers of American and European women were being sold into prostitution in places like Latin America. The fear, by the way, was exaggerated, although there was some reality to it, but the campaign was intriguing. The point is here, by the end of the 19th century, building on the effective experience of the anti-slavery crusade, a new kind of world opinion with organizations to back it, was available that could be applied to other kinds of abuse or other situations in which injustice could be perceived. The London Anti-Slavery Society, the largest, the oldest international NGO anywhere in the world, continued its operations, as it does still today, but now directed toward other forms of labor abuse. And there's really a direct connection between the kind of world opinion that had formed against slavery and more recent organizations like Amnesty International that seek to use world opinion against other abuses of human rights. This consequence of great importance for the 19th, but also the 20th century, is the final legacy of this really interesting moment in the history of the world in the long 19th century.